Okay, very good. Thank you. Okay, so we're just verifying, like, the other sessions, we're running late and we're on multiple stories, so we're trying to figure out where everyone is and if we're waiting for a session to conclude. So it looks like everybody's well on their way, and you know, if people are trickling in, so that, you know, that'll have to be fine. So we apologize on the behalf of those that come late to you, and I'd like to ask Dr. Lehman to begin the presentation. He's going to give you some medical components, and then I'll address some of the halakha considerations.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. I've had a relationship with Pua now for almost about 15, 16 years. So Rabbi Weitzman, about 2000, 2001, came to our IVF lab, which is up in Hartsdale in Westchester County. And he actually asked us if we could allow a mashgicha to come in and oversee some of the sperm and egg interactions in our laboratory. And we started our relationship then, and we've actually had a number of conferences that we both have presented internationally here in the States as well as in Israel, and we've had some writings together that have been published in some of the journals that are out there in the world on infertility. Currently, I am the Division Director of Reproductive Endocrinology at Einstein and Montefiore. We have some offices in the Bronx near the medical school, but our IVF center is up in Hartsdale, New York, in Westchester County. And I have the pleasure of talking to you about fertility preservation. So we're going to spend some time. It's a very controversial issue. It's a hot topic that is really coming into the forefront right now. So our goal for the day to talk about some of the history of cryopreservation fairly quickly. We're going to talk about some of the medical indications that exist for OSI cryopreservation, what the process is so you have a good understanding of what it would entail if someone chose to go through fertility preservation and freezing their eggs. I want to review some data because there isn't a tremendous amount of data, unfortunately, and hopefully there will be in the future. The real question that's going to be posed towards the end when we transition from my talk to Rabbi Rappaport is there a good time to be doing this? Is there a bad time to be doing this? What is the optimal time? And obviously there are some social questions that are going to be asked, and what are some of the halakhic issues? So that's going to be our talk. Hopefully I'll spend about 15 minutes with you giving you some of the medical facts. Hopefully we'll have 15 minutes of some of the social halakhic issues, and then we'll leave hopefully about 15, 20 minutes for questions. So, history of cryopreservation. The first thing we have documented is in 1953, we had the first birth from human frozen sperm, and it was published in Fertility and Sterility back in 1973. That's the major infertility journal that's available. Following that, we had something called slow freeze techniques. It was the old way we used to freeze any kind of sperm or egg. It was a very programmed process. The problem with freezing cells, they have a fair amount of fluid or water, and in particular, if you freeze too quickly, it can crystallize the cell, and unfortunately, the crystallization causes some of the spindles, which are part of mitosis and meiosis, all the things that are necessary for the embryos to keep on splitting and develop properly, that crystallization causes breakage of that mechanism. First human birth from a frozen embryo was in 1984, so the first IVF cycle was in the late 70s in England, and the first human birth was from a frozen embryo back in 84, and then we have a report in 86 that the human birth from a frozen oocyte. What's happened in the last decade is that we've changed some of the mechanisms that we use. It's something called vitrification, which is a way that has enabled the cell to be desiccated. We can remove the fluid fairly rapidly without harming that spindle apparatus that I talked about. And then you can freeze the embryo or egg once you remove the cells. When you have to thaw them, you have to somehow slowly inject fluid and let it expand without those spindles involved in mitosis and meiosis breaking. And what has happened over time is that the freezing technique using vitrification allowed for greater survival of the eggs, greater survival of the embryos, depending on what we're talking about, and it's also resulted in improved pregnancy rates. Because of those improvements in the techniques, the ASRM, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, came out with a committee opinion back in 2013 in January, that the evidence indicates that oocyte vitrification and warming should no longer be considered experimental. So until 2013, there were some sites that were freezing eggs, mostly for the purposes of cancer patients. We'll get into some of the medical indications. But there were other places that were doing voluntary egg freezing for fertility preservation for social purposes, but it was really something that should have been done under some kind of research protocol because we were not able to do it based on our guidelines that were set by our professional societies. And with the same data, they also came out with a statement that although the data are limited, there's no increase in chromosomal abnormalities, birth defects, developmental deficits, in any of the offspring born from cryopreserved oocytes, when you're comparing that to the general population going through in vitro fertilization. So when they saw that data, by the way, it was based on a paper that came out in 2010. There have been 900 live births from frozen oocytes in the world, not just the U.S., but in the world. And because they didn't see any deficits or any kind of chromosomal abnormalities in those 900 births, this is what they're basing that we should be okay and shouldn't be experimental any longer to do oocyte freezing. So let's transition into what kind of indications there would be for freezing one's eggs. Obviously, if someone has cancer, that's a gonadotoxic, meaning that the gonads, in this case a woman's ovary, would be exposed to chemotherapy or radiation. That would be a reason for cancer. There are other types of diseases as well where you may have to remove the ovaries prematurely. And if you wanted to remove those ovaries, perhaps before you remove the ovary, you let them go through some kind of cycle to enable us to recruit those eggs, take those eggs, and freeze them. Newer issues that I'm going to say are more hypothetical right now that may come down the pike. Genetic conditions, so in terms of breast cancer mutation genes. So if a woman has a breast cancer mutation gene, and she's not married right now, but it's being, if you read the papers out in the lay literature, you know that there are people out there who are actually undergoing mastectomies, as well as oophorectomies, removing of the ovaries, prematurely, because they're worried about what's going to happen if they carry the breast cancer mutation gene. Can I have a future cancer of my ovary or my breast? So potentially a young woman who knows it's in their family line, they can go through some kind of, again, stimulation cycle and allow them to make eggs or develop eggs, and we can retrieve them and freeze them for future use. And then go through the mastectomy and the oophorectomy. There are couples who go through IVF, and unfortunately the day of the procedure, the guy can't produce a specimen. That's happened to me frequently. Fortunately, now we have the ability to freeze eggs. So in the past, if the guy didn't give us a specimen that day, you couldn't do anything with the eggs. That was it. The cycle was over. So I just went through 2 or 3 weeks of hormone injections. They go through an egg retrieval. And at the end of the day, you have nothing to do with the eggs. But now that we have the ability to freeze eggs, there are situations that do come up because the guy can't produce a specimen, and we can freeze the eggs. The next possibility, which I've seen frequently, not so much with Jewish couples, but actually Catholic couples who have an issue with going through in vitro fertilization and creating embryos. So what they come to you is they say to you, we need to go through IVF. We only want you to fertilize 2 or 3 eggs at a time. If I'm making 10, freeze the next 7 eggs, and we'll use it later on. They don't want to have any existing embryos. They have a problem with the embryos. They look at the embryos as a life, as opposed to looking just at cells. And when they have extra or supernumerary embryos and they don't know what to do with them afterwards, they struggle with, well, I don't want to use them. I already have my twins, or I already have 4 children, and now I have 7 embryos. And they look at them as if they're a child, and they have to treat them equally to all the other embryos or children they've had that they've gone through pregnancy. The last possibility is what I think most of you probably hear for, is elective cryopreservation to defer childbearing. So that's the social issue that's becoming right in the forefront of the lay media and the lay press, and we'll talk about that in detail. So what kind of steps does one have to go through when they go through egg cryopreservation? They need to go through an assessment of their ovarian function or ovarian reserve, which if you were in some of the courses you heard today or classes you had today, there are different ways to do that. I want to go into the details of that, but we assess the ovaries to see if the ovary still has good potential to give us lots of eggs. They have to go through a process of infectious disease screening. That's any kind of tissue freezing. Anytime we have any kind of embryos, sperm, eggs that we put into our tanks in our laboratory, they need to go through a series of blood tests, HIV testing, syphilis testing, hepatitis screening, etc. A big part of the process is they have to go through certain kinds of counseling. The counseling could be psychological counseling, because what does it mean if I'm actually putting aside my eggs? Counseling in terms of my medical advice based on what their results are of their ovarian testing. But there's a lot of financial implications because no insurance is right now pay for egg-free. This is completely out of pocket. The insurance companies do not recognize this as anything at all. Even if you have a cancer diagnosis, they say this is not a fertility problem. I'm very, very sorry. So a person comes to you who has a breast cancer diagnosis, she's starting chemotherapy in 3 weeks, and we've been able to convince the oncologist to delay things. When they come in and you put down a breast cancer diagnosis, the insurance company says that's a breast cancer diagnosis, it's not a fertility problem. We're very, very sorry. It's going to cost you whatever the price is for egg freezing across, you know, the gamuts of the different fertility centers.
What is the usual? What is the range? In the New York area.
In the New York area, I can tell you that at Einstein, we charge $3,500 for it. We also know our population of patients, because we're servicing a fair number of patients in the Bronx who can't afford it. They go into the city, it's at least $10,000. And that's, forget about the maintenance fee that you have to pay after the fact, so now you have frozen eggs and you may not use it for 10 years and you can charge about $1,000 a year just to maintain those embryos and that frozen status. So it's not an inconsequential amount of money to go through it, especially if you're a young woman and you're not sure when you may use them or you may never use them, which is the other side of it. So it's almost like an insurance policy. Okay, so the next thing is what the actual process is. You go through something called controlled ovarian hyperstimulation. We're taking injectable hormones for about 10 days to 14 days of the cycle. you then go through an oocyte retrieval, which is a surgical procedure done under anesthesia. It goes through the vaginal walls with no incisions, but you have to go through that. And then once we get 10 eggs, we have to sift through the eggs and look to make sure that the eggs are in a certain stage of meiosis called metaphase 2. If you don't make it to the metaphase 2 stage, that egg is discarded. So these are just some pictures of a metaphase 2 oocyte. This thing over here is called a polar body. This is the zona pellucida, which is just a hard protein coat around the outside of the egg. And if you don't have this polar body, it means you didn't make it to metaphase 2. So there are other types of eggs that you can see don't have in any part of the periphery of the egg cell. It doesn't have that polar body. It's called an M1 or metaphase 1. It's immature, as well as something called the germinal vesicle, which is even before metaphase 1. This also is an egg that you couldn't use for the process. So in terms of the timing of the cycle, I told you that you have about 10 to 14 days of injections. This could be 2 to 3 injections a day. Again, you're starting your stimulation. Let's just assume this is day 1. You're taking some gonadotropins, which are brain hormones that make the egg respond normally. We give it to you in excess. You're on it for about 10 to 14 days. Simultaneous to that, you start something called a GnRH antagonist, a gonadotropin releasing hormone antagonist, which prevents a woman from ovulating. So normally what happens when you reach a certain threshold level of estrogen, your brain signals that you should release an egg. You have to be on a second medication to prevent that egg release. And then right when you have the right size mature follicles on your ultrasounds that we're doing every other day or so, you trigger them with an HCG injection, human chorionic gonadotropin, and then 36 hours later you have an egg retrieval. So this is a figure somewhere between a 12 to 14 day process beginning to end in terms of stimulation, besides all the prior evaluation and counseling that takes place before that. What also doesn't get spoken about is that once you go through this process, now you have frozen eggs, what happens at the other end of it? And so now I have my frozen eggs for 5 years, and I'm now 38 years old, I'm 40 years old, I finally find the guy in my life, what do I do with my eggs? You actually have to go through a process of what's called an embryo transfer. We have to thaw out the eggs, we have to inseminate the eggs. Because they've been frozen, we're required to do something called ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, because the shell hardens in the freezing process. We take a micro needle and we force the one sperm directly into that egg. It has to go through a division process, and then hopefully at the end of the division process we'll have some embryos to choose from, and we'll transfer one or two embryos depending on age of the patient, etc., and stuff like that. So if I go through 10 eggs that I was able to freeze, and now I fertilize or inseminate all those eggs, and I now have 7 embryos to choose from, I may take the best one or two to transfer, and then I'm going to have 5 embryos that I can set aside to freeze for later use. So they go through, again, another process to freeze the embryos the second time. The main issue that we have to understand is that when you talk about fertility and fertility cryopreservation, the major issue is how fertile is the woman, and a lot of it has to do with her age. And again, there were some people, I think, who were in the room for the last session. That was a very nice session that talked about secondary infertility. But talked about, you know, what kind of ovarian reserve does a woman have. So at birth, you have the most number of follicles that you would have. somewhere between 1 to 2 million follicles at birth. By the time that woman reaches puberty, which is usually around 12 and a half, she has about 300,000 follicles. So there's a tremendous loss between the million to 300,000. She ovulates every month, but she doesn't have 300,000 to 400,000 cycles between the age of 12 and a half and the average age of 52. And she loses lots, many more eggs per cycle than she actually releases during the course of that cycle. And then, obviously, in this country, the average age of menopause is around 51, 52. And after that, the woman's completely infertile, but somewhere between that time, she could be subfertile, but there are some significant changes that take place that make it very difficult for women to get pregnant once she's past, actually, 42 or so. So to give you some real data that's out there, this is historical data that's accumulated way back in Europe for years and years ago. This is just on the x-axis. It's just the age of the wife. And you can see as a woman ages, there's a significant drop-off in all these different populations they looked at. This is married couples not using contraception. So you can see there's a big dip sometime after 35. So there is a slow decline, but once you hit 35, there's a tremendous dip going down. And most people can't conceive once they're in their mid to late 40s at all. So when we do studies in the IVF world, or even the general reproductive technology world, not just IVF, we try to find some good, comparable populations that you can work with to get an idea of what the real numbers are like. So back in 1982, so it's a while back, they did studies on women who had men who were azoospermic. They had husbands or partners that didn't have any sperm at all, and they had to go through donor insemination. So what they found out is that if you did up to 12 inseminations, you had 74% of those women who were less than 31 in basically a year's time of doing one insemination a month had a pregnancy. If you were between 31 and 35, it was 62%, and if you were above 35, it dropped down to 54%. Again, not a great population to study because it's only, I mean, they're trying to, trying to control as many variables as possible and saying that these are women who don't have a male problem right now because I'm using donor sperm to make that happen. So those are real numbers that took place in hundreds and hundreds of cycles of women who went through. And to compare that, just to give you an idea of what we're dealing with in today's world in terms of IVF, in 2013, we have to report to the CDC or SART, the Society of Assisted Reproductive Technology. There were 175,000 IVF cycles that took place in the United States. Percentage of cycles resulting in live birth. So if I was talking to a couple today and said you're going to about to start an IVF cycle, a woman who's less than 35 has a 40% chance of delivering a baby. Again, forgetting about anything about her diagnosis, just walking in my door today, if you start a cycle, no matter what your diagnosis is, this is your chance of delivering a baby for that one cycle. It's 31% if you're between this age. It's 21% if you're 38 to 40. It's 11% if you're 41 to 42. And it drops off precipitously. Again, these two numbers are pretty poor for a cycle of in vitro fertilization. So again, it's not a perfect way to assess what the natural history is of pregnancy in the world, but this is real data that we have available to us. And I bring this to you because what we talk about is that IVF and ICSI rates that we currently see are what is probably going to be the success rate for fertility, cryopreservation, or fertility, or cryopreserving of your oocytes, all dependent on the age of the woman at the time they're actually frozen. This is actually maybe a little bit hard to see, but these are the four studies that were used by the ASRM to say that we should be going through, taking away the experimental nature. And just to give you an idea why I brought it up there, it's because these two studies were all done on oocyte donors. So they compared fresh oocytes being used for egg donation versus frozen oocytes used for donation, but the women were less than 30 years of age. And what they said is that if you're less than 30 years of age, the comparison for fresh versus frozen oocytes is almost equivalent. And I'll take you through the numbers in a sec. This is actually done, this was done in Spain. These two were done in Italy. They're a couple, Italy also is a couple, it's a place that doesn't allow you to freeze embryos. So they only use three eggs, fertilize them, and anything that's extra, over and above the three eggs, they freeze them. So what they did comparison studies of what it was like to use the fresh eggs versus the frozen eggs, and again, they came out with some numbers that were pretty good. What was nice about these studies is that they went up to women who were at least up to 43 years of age. They actually saw pregnancies in some of the older women who went through, maybe more generalizable to the population because they dealt with real people as opposed to what was going on here, to show that they could use the process of freezing eggs as a means of good technology. So again, the largest randomized trial was in Spain. Just to give you some numbers, and this is how they report the numbers right now when talking about OSI cryopreservation. 92% of the OSI survived the thaw. Fertilization rate was 74%. They compared vitrification versus the slow freeze. So you saw that there was 74% versus 73%. It's pretty equivalent. Implantation rates for the stuff that went through vitrification, versus fresh. Yes, it's fresh. Again, similar numbers, fresh versus frozen. Pregnancy rates for transfer, again, same kind of thing. And again, rates are similar to young women undergoing in vitro fertilization. So again, this was a donor egg population, and they showed that the rates were pretty similar in women who were less than 30 years of age. That's the best data that we have. This came out in 2010. There's no randomized control trial, which means there's no comparison group. Everything's always just observational. In my clinic, I did 100 of these, and this was my success rate. Or they retrospectively analyzed what they did, and they could always pick and choose what they want. So what was nice about this study, it was prospective. They randomized people coming into my clinic. You're going to do this fresh, you're going to do it frozen, and they made a comparison, and this is how we decided that we should permit oocyte cryopreservation. So issues, more data is becoming available. Again, not everything that we're talking about can be generalized to the rest of the population because of the type of population the initial studies were done on. There are some very complicated statistical analyses being done that are trying to determine what is the optimal age and time to have one's eggs frozen. And it seems that the ages between 35 and 37, depending on which article you read, seems to be the limit in terms of cost effectiveness. Doesn't mean you can't do it afterwards. Doesn't mean you can't get pregnant if you freeze those eggs. Because you have to question how many eggs I'm going to be able to get, and how many eggs will be viable, functional eggs doing what they need to do. Because, again, as women age, pregnancy rates decline, and the rate of what's called aneuploidy, or chromosomal abnormalities, also increases. So the question is, again, what is the cost effectiveness, and what should we be telling couples or women what they should be doing? So I'm going to give you a few slides of take-home points, and I'm going to get Rabbi Rappaport up here, and we'll have hopefully a conversation about some of these things. So fertility preservation is no longer experimental. We talked about numerous medical indications, one particular which I know is a big social issue in terms of our communities, in terms of deferring childbearing to later in life. Very important to have the appropriate counseling before you go through the whole process. Obviously, we need more data to make sure we're giving the important information. We have very little data about what the impact is on all this manipulation in the laboratory. And again, the optimal age should be somewhere between 35 and 37. And again, if you're above 37, you could do it, but you have to appreciate that the success rates may be very different than in women who are coming in less than 35 years of age. And then the social issues that are really going to start coming out in the real world. So what happened about a year or so ago is that both Apple and Facebook said that this is now part of the human resources benefits package, that they're now offering $20,000 worth of oocyte cryopreservation as part of their insurance package. So if you have any understanding of that, and if you read any newspapers at that point in time, it's a big issue because there were some women's groups saying, how dare you tell women that it's okay to delay childbearing by freezing their eggs as opposed to maybe paying for maternity leave and getting pregnant at a younger age. So this is something that's really in the forefront of the media, and there were a lot of op-ed articles that came out related to both of these, both of these groups offering this, and you may see it happen more frequently in the near future. So I just put up my contact information if anyone wants any more information from me. You can reach me at Einstein or my office in Hartsdale, and I'm going to turn it over to Rabbi Rappaport, and hopefully we'll have some kind of discussion back and forth if we can.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we're going to pick up here. So you have a bit of a background now of the scientific and medical reality that's involved with cryopreservation, egg freezing. And we'll give you a little bit of the Jewish perspective. And ultimately, I'll come out right now and say why we at Pua think it's important, why we think it has a place in the Jewish world, and why and what role it can play. So first of all, the first question is, we have to, like anything in Judaism, we have to ask, is it permissible? You have to ask, the first thing, we're a religion that's based on halacha, on laws, there are do's and don'ts, so what are the criteria here? So the first thing that one would ask is in general, there is a principle when undergoing any medical procedure, is one allowed, obviously if a procedure is deemed required, there's no shaila, there's no question, one does whatever medical procedure needs to be done. But when electing to do elective procedures, there is a shaila. Now we know there are tshuvas, there are answers, even regarding elective plastic surgery, Rabbi Moshe gave heterim in certain, as did other rabbonim. So, but the question, in at least hypothetically, exists. Is it permissible to undergo an elective procedure? It's not a serious procedure, but you're submitting the body to a hormonal treatment, light anesthesia. So at the very least, it's a question. Ultimately, I would say that majority of poskim who see value in the procedure would dismiss this as not being a concern. I'm just saying that on the elementary level it exists as a question. The next concern for, of course, a single woman would be anything to do with the loss of dam basulin, possibly losing the hymenal membrane and thereby not being considered a basula, a virgin, halachically. Again, this is not a tremendous concern. The procedure can be done without this being disrupted. The reason I bring it up is because we did have a case in Pua where a girl called from England and said that she wanted to undergo the procedure. She was older and so on. And she had asked her family rabbi, and her rabbi told her because of this concern not to proceed with the procedure. So there is at least that perspective out there. I don't know how prevalent or how common it is in the halachic world, but that could be a concern. Again, if you're aware of that, you can tell the doctor and chances are it won't be an issue. Okay, so another background issue is this is a reasonably new phenomenon. So if we just look a little bit back into the past, before there was the option to freeze eggs, what were people doing? Like anytime there's something new, people say, well, we survived until now, so why do we need to do this now? Well, you know, it's like people always look back on the good old days, that they were good old days, but they weren't really such good old days after all. So the good old days, we used to get shilas in Pua all the time. Women would call and say, I'm 35, I'm 40, whatever the case, and I've been in Shidduchim for 20 years, and I'm giving up. And if Hashem wants, maybe I'll get married, maybe I won't, but likelihood I'm not going to get married, but I don't want to give up on motherhood. It's not fair just because I didn't find a shidduch, I didn't find a match, that I shouldn't be able to be a mother. I want to be a mother. And so they're asking for a heter to do artificial insemination using donor sperm. And there is no heter for that. There is no posek that we're familiar with. That has said this is a good option. So it became to somewhat. I have a brother who lives in Israel. He spent some time in Katamon, where all the singles of Israel hang out. He said this was a discussion at every Shabbos table: egg freezing, artificial insemination. For years, this is a very popular topic to discuss over chulent. But the ma'aseh is that 10 years ago, this was a problem. And there were women who were going out and were doing artificial insemination without a heter. And that was the situation that Rabbanim were presented with. Now what do we do? This is happening in our communities. How do we address it? How do we stop it? How do we deal with it? It was a thing all by itself. Then came the era of vitrification, which really made a big difference in the whole process of cryopreservation, of egg freezing, and suddenly egg freezing became more available, more accessible, and a more, based on the success rates and so on and so forth, and the ASRM, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, removing the experimental status from it just a few years ago, it really has begun to gain a lot of popularity as an option. So, based on this, at Pua, we advocate and we support women freezing eggs. We think this is a good solution. We think it prevents the concern of women trying to get pregnant independently. It alleviates that halachic concern. We feel, now to be fair, the criticism that we get from other rabbis or rabbinic associations or what have you, I'm actually not familiar with big condemnations, but I'm sure it's out there somewhere. But the criticism that exists is, well, you're encouraging people not to get married. And you're encouraging people not to have children. So obviously that is a ridiculous remark, because the whole, that would be an antithetical essence. Everything about Pura is about helping couples to have children. That's really what we do every day. So to say that somehow we're encouraging people to not have children is a little absurd. But ultimately, so we believe there needs to be some sort of parameters, you know. So it's hard to say that there's a hard rule, and at an exact age it's appropriate, and at an exact age it's not appropriate. But as a very general line in the sand, we feel that up until the age of 30, a woman shouldn't be concerned with egg freezing. That's a reasonable age, a reasonable amount of time to be in shidduchim. Say a woman starts 20, 22, 23, you know, people start various ages. And up until the age of 30, we would say it's premature, and that would be leaning on the side of, you know, the social component of, you know, encouraging people not to seek, you know, the not to pursue having a family and getting married in the ordinary sense. Once a woman hits 30, and again, 30 is not a magical number, but it's a number that we found useful in Israel and in America in practical application, that if a woman's been involved in shidduchim for close to 10 years, and she's worried about shidduchim, and she's worried about the... and on top of everything else, is now beginning to worry about fertility. So we feel, where it's possible, there's a financial component that is, you know, not insignificant whatsoever, but it's a very good, where it's possible, it's a very good opportunity for the individual to alleviate at least one source of stress and worry that they have in their life. So every day they wake up and they're concerned, will I get married, will I ever be married, my younger sister's married, my younger brother's married, what's going to happen to me? And am I ever going to have kids? How do I, every day that goes by, my ovarian reserve, my fertility rate, and they're living with this ogmus nefesh every single day. So we can't do anything about everything, but here's an opportunity to have that person remove the a portion of that burden from their shoulders. And we really have seen situations where a person no longer under such heavy duress is now better able to address everything in life, and ultimately, you know, has better luck, if we want to call it luck, in shidduchim subsequently. I'll tell you a story that's both a success story and a source of concern, and you can see why this is, you know, this is always a work in progress. So as a general rule, overall, we think that the benefits outweigh the concerns, but with, you know, to be fair, we'll say what the concerns are as well. So you have a couple. The man is 45 and the woman's 43, and everything's perfect, and the shadchan says, I want them to get together, and the husband-to-be, the man, says he's not interested because he wants to have a family. At 43, she's not likely to get pregnant. As arrogant as it may be, men are known to be arrogant sometimes. So he may say that and say, I'm not going to go out. I'll go out with somebody up to 35. But if the same couple exists and the shadchan says, she's 43, but she froze eggs when she was 33. So now he's going to go out, and the couple are perfect for each other, and they're going to get married, live happily ever after, and they're going to go to Dr. Lehman's clinic here and do IVF with the frozen oocytes, and they'll have a beautiful family, and Shalom al Yisrael, and everything's fine. Here's the concern to that. So 43 is, you know, 43, 44, that's an age where it's a real issue. What would happen if in the world of shidduchim a girl hits a certain age at 37, 38, 39, and suddenly families, prospective families, start asking shadchanim, does she have frozen eggs? That potentially could become an issue. And then it becomes, well, oh, she doesn't have it, no. And then, people not based on science or empirical data, in, you know, it's known to happen in the Jewish world, people get a little crazy. So then if a mishugas begins, there's no stopping it. So then they're going to say, at 35, people are going to start saying, oh, does she have frozen eggs? Even though that's really a perfectly normal age. And who knows, so that's a concern that it may happen, but it hasn't happened yet. And the benefits still outweigh the potential concern. Obviously the social component of Apple, Facebook, etc. is something that we completely oppose. So if somebody were to say, you know, Pua supports egg freezing in the same way that Apple does, so that would be incorrect. We oppose the concept of postponing motherhood, postponing having children, postponing getting married, that whole social component that Apple and et al. Are promoting. Parenthetically, you know, you could hear from my accent, I'm not originally American, so as an American citizen, I can say, in the developed world, it's absurd that an American maternity leave is as poorly addressed as it is. And, you know, Dr. Lehman touched on it briefly, but perhaps if the HR package addressed maternity leave more than it addressed egg preservation, that would address the issue from a more wholesome and acceptable approach. But, you know, the rest of the world is much, much more advanced, I would have to say, in this area. Okay, so, I mean, in a nutshell, those are the main issues. What we haven't started this, what we haven't spoken about at all, and what's really not out there yet, is male fertility preservation. That's another discussion, but just to throw it out there, as an issue, we haven't seen a trend. Obviously, male infertility or decline in male fertility happens much later, but now more and more studies have come out pointing to impaired fertility or subfertility with males, and we wonder, not in the Jewish sense necessarily, but in the social overall fertility world, if now it's becoming quote-unquote trendy for females to undergo fertility preservation, if in 5 years or so we're going to see a similar trend in the male factor, and then what ramifications that may have in the halachic world is yet to be seen. But, you know, we'll deal with, you know, we talk about Ezo Chacham Arayas Anoma, they have to try and anticipate what's coming, but ultimately this is something that's already here and has tremendous benefits when applied appropriately. Must just give one last thing and say, when egg freezing is done, it's important to have halachic supervision. That's something we do at Pua. And halachic supervision simply entails having a mashkicha, supervisor present during the lab, in the lab during the process, and then when the egg is retrieved from the woman and placed into the particular container, the Pua supervisor will put a seal on it that only another poor supervisor is able to open. And this ensures that if that woman uses it in 5 years or 10 years or never, that's never opened without somebody from our team. And this guarantees the yuchsin, the halachic lineage of the individual. There's never a chance of even a small chance of any problems going wrong. And this is halachically important. So you could have a sad situation where a woman paid to have her eggs preserved and is going through shiduchim, and then they say, does she have frozen eggs? And they say yes, and then they say, well, did they do it with supervision? And they say no, then they could say, well, we're not interested. It's a very possible situation. So rather than have a shaila down the track, do it the right way the first time. Okay, we'd like to open up to questions.
There's nothing out there. That's, I mean, for women, it's all going to be based mostly on egg donation. There's a probably less than 1% chance that a woman will have a complication from an egg donation cycle. But if those women go on and usually have children afterwards without any real issues. By making more eggs for that one particular month, or if it's 2 months, you're losing those eggs anyway. Even though you're only developing one egg, in a typical classic cycle of 28 days, you're releasing one egg, but you're actually losing more than just the one egg that's being released for ovulation purposes. So when we're recruiting eggs in that process, those were probably eggs that were quite destined to either be released a different month or we're losing them that month. And they don't get menopause earlier, they don't have things that happen to them that would, you know, suggest that you're decreasing their fertility.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I heard you clearly and I have a follow-up. In the entire world, as of, I think, 2013, there have been only 900 successful pregnancies from frozen
eggs. At least what's in the literature. The last one I saw, it was dated from 2010. And it was, I'm sure there's going to be another round of it coming out very shortly, telling us that there are now 1,500 deliveries.
Right.
But you have to understand, a lot of people are not using those eggs. So in the real world, so again, if you're having it for cancer purposes, I can tell you we do it all the time. We're freezing eggs for cancer patients. I can't tell you that I've used a lot of those eggs. I don't know what it's going to be, depending on what their lives are like 5 years after their treatment. And now you're talking about a whole different population of patients that are just doing it for social purposes. They may never use it. So we have these eggs sitting around right now. No one's coming back and saying, I want to use them. So they're very few.
Right. Just one follow-up. Yes. And do we have a number based on the 2010 available research of the number of those 900 that were eggs collected from women ages 35 to 37 when collected at an older age?
I think there are some numbers in there, but it's not a dramatic amount. I
mean,
No.
It's also why it's important, if you're already considering doing it, to do it at the appropriate age. You know, so to come at 37 and say, I want to freeze eggs, it might be better than nothing, but you know, to a large extent, you may have missed the boat here. You know, freezing at 32 would have made a big difference.
So the director's only a few hundred.
Right. And you're gonna see more and more of it now. I mean, it's going to be out there because people are doing as much. There's a lot of promotion going on. There's a place called Egg Banks in the city that invited me. I haven't gone to it, but they've invited us to have cocktail parties with young women who want to learn about egg freezing. So it becomes very social. It's very uncomfortable to me, being in an academic center, that that's what people are talking about. So, but it's going to be out there, and hopefully the data will be there. Yeah.
Could you comment on single motherhood? You can use singles, halakhically, and...
How would that be different than a single woman using the just doing artificial insemination?
No, just in general, artificial insemination or this method.
No, right. So the premise to do it halakhically is that the woman should get married and do it within marriage. There isn't a heter that the woman would freeze her eggs as a single woman and then go on to use them as a single woman.
So what are the issues, pros and cons, about a single woman become
a mother? Well, it doesn't really, I don't see an issue halakhically that's any worse that a single woman would use her own frozen eggs versus using her eggs naturally to conceive. Halakhically it's problematic all by itself, so this doesn't make it any worse or any better. It's just, it remains a halakhically problematic area.
Well, it's better because it's done in a test tube, and then it's
saying there's less yuchsin. Maybe.
Maybe,
but if you're using donor sperm from a non-Jew, which is, you know, at the very least the responsible thing to do based on the poskim, then anyway, there's no yuchsin to the
service a single woman who would say, I want to do this and have a baby.
We would not offer supervision. They could freeze eggs as a single woman. But if they came back and said, now we want to do insemination, that's an interesting shiloh. If they did it with Pua and we have the seal on it, and now they say they want to break the seal, you know, at the end of the day, they could probably do it with signing a waiver and then we're no longer in the picture. But we wouldn't go and do hashkafa, the supervision, on a case with a single mother. And we do still get calls like that. I got a call from a secular Israeli woman who lives in America. That's why she called us in New York, on our Israeli office. And, you know, you have to try to figure out what the real Shaila is, but ultimately she wanted to find out if a child is going to be Jewish, not religious, but she wants the child at least to be Jewish, and, you know, what could we do for her? So I had to explain to her that, you know, halakhically that's not what we do, and we're not able to service her, but, you know, give her at least a little understanding of why and what the parameters are.
What supervision is needed for IVF for a couple who are undergoing IVF?
So for IVF, it's important to have supervision when any of the genetic material, sperm, eggs, embryos, are in the lab. So they're not always locked away or, you know, or put away in the incubator. There's interaction. The embryologist is taking them out, checking things. There's the actual process of the fertilization. And the supervision means that a mashgicha is present the entire time when that material is out there. So it doesn't mean she sleeps in the lab. At the end of the day, they're going to put it in an incubator, and we will put a seal on it. And then when they, on the third day, sometimes they do a check, we'll have a mashgicha go back, open the seal for the embryologist, and we'll be there while it's open, put another seal on when it's closed. So that way, it's completely guaranteed to the full integrity that there's no chance of any mix-up or human error. So you're dealing with a situation where a couple's conceiving children in a non-natural way. In a natural way, it's very easy to know who the parents from both sides are. And knowing who the parents are halachically is important. Whether it's an issue of, is the child Jewish, is the child a mamzer, is the child a bechor, is the child a kohen, is the child going to marry a sibling? Like, there's all kinds of potential halachic concerns. And because this is a halachic concern, we don't say, well, we can rely on the lab being pretty good or being 99.something% good. We need 1,000% that we have halachic complete knowledge, yediyah, that this is the case. And Rav Eliyashiv once said that even if he were working in the lab, you would still have to have supervision because you couldn't rely on him as somebody employed by the lab. You need to have a third-party individual. That was Rav Eliyashiv told us a few years ago.
Just to add to that, so years ago when we started working with Pua, what they've done, so you have the incubators which had like little tags or locks on them actually, and we would give the keys with mashbicha, would come in every day while the eggs or embryos are incubating. But now you're asking about frozen, what do you do with the frozen? So he's talking about issues of having the straws, what we call the straws, that they're putting a tag on that. What we did initially, because the straws weren't like that, so we had embryos frozen that were under Pua supervision. We actually have, they built up a special tank within a tank that only Pua has access to. So when the couple wants to come back another time and use those embryos, they actually have to, we could put in our liquid nitrogen to store everything, and we just don't have access to those embryos until someone from their office comes in and actually opens up that special part of our tank that they made for us.
Pua came about when IVF came about. In other words, in the beginning stages, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu commissioned the Menachem Bushin as the dean of Pua and said, these scientific developments are coming about. At that stage, the Poskim were very skeptical about ever allowing IVF in the Jewish community, and he gave them the charge, find a way to make this happen. See if there's a way that halakhically could be compatible. So we've been, we've been using supervision really since IVF was starting out. I don't know the numbers, but early on it was very few, and now there's dozens and dozens of cases a day where there are supervised mashgichot in different places. There's another shot a couple of times, they weren't prum at the time and so on, and then they had children with IVF. So that's the question that on a case-by-case basis they'll address. I don't think that it will be detrimental, but we don't live in a world of how to pass into the evidence. We live in a world of lechatchila. So if you're going to do the procedure, so you want to do it the best way that's compliant with 90% of the poskim, why wouldn't you do that rather than rely on the evidence if it's going to be okay? That's sort of our view on that.
So what about if the egg and the sperm is from a non-Jewish person and the husband contributed
his Jewish sperm,
does that need the same supervision? If the egg is
non-Jewish,
the baby would need to be converted?
That's a whole halakhic question all by itself, with egg donation. Here we're talking more about fertility preservation. But that's a question. And people do egg donation, and there are heterim for it. It needs to be a case-by-case heter. You can't just, assume that it's allowed. And whether or not you should use a non-Jewish egg is a discussion halachically, and whether or not that child be Jewish, it's a very diverse area halachically. There is nothing near a consensus, so it's difficult to say, but there still is a role for supervision. Obviously, there's less, there's only genetic material that's authentically from the husband, but you still want to, to guarantee that that's indeed, what's going on.
Is there a danger of cancer in women getting all these injections?
So there is very poor data as well for that. The problem is that women who have a hard time getting pregnant or are infertile are already at risk for ovarian cancer. breast cancer as well, versus a population of patients who don't have fertility problems. So the question becomes, is it the drugs that we're giving, or the hormones that we're giving these women, all these injections, are they causing the problem, or is it the patient population that we're working with? And multiple studies are out there. Every few years it becomes a hot topic again, and they try to figure out what the best way to set up a model to assess that, and at the end of the day, there's no evidence that there's any kind of significant difference between the populations. But it's a concern that people have, but there's nothing been, I'll say it's an association, but there's no definitive proof that exists. Yeah.
I think you mentioned that IVF is 36 hours.
Before you take the egg out.
So is there a difference
between eggs to be frozen for longer than an IVF treatment? How would that happen? Eggs to be frozen for years, do you need to get them in 36 hours for IVF? I'm not sure I understand the question. So with IVF, what you're doing is you're developing multiple egg counts, and then you have to allow them to ovulate. So normally a woman's brain triggers the right hormone to make her release those eggs. And she's got 36 hours from the time that she would release that hormone to then develop, you know, an ovulation. So what we're doing is giving them a similar hormone that's going to cause the ovulation 36 hours later. So what we do is, if I give an injection tonight on a Sunday night for a woman who's about to have her egg retrieved on Tuesday, she has to be in my laboratory by 9 or 11 o'clock on Tuesday, otherwise she's going to ovulate those eggs in her own body. Nothing to do with freezing. So we're doing this, we're retrieving those eggs, and then after we retrieve the eggs, we would then strip them and count them to see if they reach that metaphase 2 stage, and then we freeze them. So if you give me 15 eggs and 15 have reached that metaphase 2 of meiosis, then we would freeze those eggs and 15. If you only have 10 of those 15 that were making metaphase 2, then we would just take those 10 and destroy the other 5 because we can't use them later on. With IVF, what you're doing is you're going to fertilize those eggs. So on Tuesday morning, when I retrieve those eggs on that woman, I'm going to take sperm that day and inseminate those eggs whichever way possible, and then develop the embryos through incubation over several days. And then I'm going to take the best one or two and transfer the best one or two embryos on day 5. And then if she has any extra ones, those in bubbles, one or two, I can freeze those. And you can keep those. I've had, just recently, we used someone's embryos from 1999. And they were successful. Well, you can freeze it for a long
time. One last question, and we'll wrap up. Okay, it's one question. So Mashkikago's been training at Pua. There's a training, you know, several sessions where they learn, you know, just the basic halakhic considerations, what they're there for. They'll learn the medical realities, what's in the lab, what materials they're going to be looking at, what are the various apparatus in the lab. Company another mashkicha several times to see in action, and ultimately we have mashkicha in around 100 labs in the United States today. Obviously, some of them are more frequent than others. Some out of town, and some in the you know, higher populated Jewish areas like New York, Los Angeles, and others. And also, you know, and around the world also, we have presence throughout Europe, Australia, and so on. So thank you, everybody. We'll be around if you have any more questions individually. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dr. Lee, and thank you for all the advocates. I'm going to ask you all a favor, please fill out the evaluation form so we can do it. Yes, of course. Good. As good of government as it is. Yes. 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 Yes.
Good.